and eat candy bars and Skittles, and Bedford organizes one of his cattle drives, a puppy blowout, Sammy calls it, and the two of them race through the apartment, barking and laughing, until Jessica says enough is enough, and they have to go back home. Before he leaves, though, Sammy sidles up to me and whispers, "Have you looked at the book yet?" I shake my head, and he says, "Please, you've got to at least look at it." I glance over at it, still on the bookshelf, but I don't go open it up. Although, I can't say for sure why not. 32. Marnie. Once it's the first week in November, the weather turns sharply colder, becoming at last what I've been expecting from New York all along. The wind whips around corners and up and down the streets. It plays with the litter, sending papers and plastic bags dancing along the sidewalks. Taking Bedford out for one of his daily walks and squirrel chasing sessions, I watch a white plastic shopping bag do a tantalizing waltz until a bare treetop reaches out and holds it close. I tell Jeremy in one of our daily phone calls that it's as if a referee suddenly blew a whistle and said, "Change!" And the old summer team limped off the court, and the wild, windy fall team came dashing out, young and energetic and whirling around. It's so un-Florida-like. So un-California-like. Winter will come after that, and it will be Christmas, and then I will leave. Less than 2 months from now. My family is already talking about how fun it will be when we're all together again. Amelia's first Christmas, the stockings, the Christmas turkey, the millions of little shiny ornaments my mother thinks it's fun to hang everywhere. Jeremy says it's going to be amazing, having a big family Christmas for once, and not the tiny little twosome Christmas he and his mom usually endure. Already my mother has invited him to bring his mother over to be with my family. He's actually been taking our two moms out for breakfast some weekend mornings, and he says it's lovely, seeing them chatting so amiably about us. I cannot imagine. "Us," he says, and my nerve endings curdle with guilt when he utters that word. Then he says, "You know, maybe you should contact a real estate agent so that when the time comes to sell, everything will be in place." He says, "I miss you so much that I'm going to have to be physically restrained from carting you off somewhere when you get off the plane." "Huh," I say. One morning, I awaken because the entire building is banging and clanging, and then shuddering like the Huns have arrived and are pelting its bricks with iron bars. Noah is up, already taking a shower. The whole commotion seems to be originating from downstairs, so I grab my phone and start typing. "Patrick, are you okay?"
"Yes. Welcome to the heating system poltergeist, harbinger of winter."
"What does it want? Money? An animal sacrifice?"
"No, it's friendly. It just has air in its pipes. Wants you to know about it. By the way, curious that your thoughts go right to animal sacrifice. Things going okay, dog-wise?"
"Why do you ask? I happen to love wearing chewed-up shoes."
"This is what gives dogs a bad name, and I'm not referring to the rather brilliant name of Bedford."
"You think that's a brilliant name? Thank you!"
"Ah, shucks. I think anything beyond Rover or Spot is brilliant. By the way, what does the gentleman of the house think of your canine friend?"
"He's not the gentleman of the house."
"Could have fooled me. Could have fooled him, for that matter."
It takes me a little while to compose myself again, and then I type, "It's complicated."
"Is he planning on leaving anytime soon?"
"Good talk. Gotta go feed the dog." A few days later, I'm at Best Buds when an elderly man comes in. He has the pained appearance of a man who needs to ask somebody a huge question, and so I ask him if there's anything I can do for him. He says no, looking around furtively, like he's sure I'm hiding something in the palm tree. So I leave him to ramble with his thoughts. He drifts over to the orchids in the cooler and stands with his hands in his pockets, looking at the tight little roses. And then he moves along to gaze for a while at the feathered greenery. And then his eyes suddenly swerve over to me. I look down at the counter quickly. He clears his throat, and I smile at him. Our eyes meet.
"I guess I'm not ready,"
he says abruptly. And, just like that, he leaves the store. If I were a different sort of person, if I were, say, Blix, perhaps I would run to the door and call after him. Perhaps I would say, "Oh, but sir, no one ever thinks of themselves as ready. From the look of you, you are ripe, right this minute." But I am me, Marnie McGraw, and so he slips away down the street.
2 months ago today, I was with her when she died.
I'm walking home from Best Buds, and it's dark now that we're back on Eastern Standard Time. I have to walk fast because it's freaking cold, but this text stops me in my tracks. I lean against a mailbox and type, "I need to talk about her. Can I come down?"
"No. Well, maybe." "Yes, okay."
That seems to cover all the possibilities. I tell you what, I'll bring a chicken because I'm starving. I wait to see what he'll say, and when he doesn't say anything, I stop at Paco's and pick up a rotisserie chicken, some mashed potatoes, and broccoli rabe. Paco, standing behind the high counter near the front of the store, is almost giddy with happiness tonight, but he says he can't tell me why. Not yet, but soon. Still, he comes around the counter and hugs me when he gives me the bag of food.
"How many people are you feeding tonight? Just you, or you and that bandito?"
He makes a face.
"Sorry, I shouldn't say that."
"Who's the bandito?" "Oh, you mean Noah?" "Noah is Blix's grandnephew, Paco."
"I don't like him."
He turns to his assistant, George, who's squatting down stocking the shelves, and George laughs.
"Nobody like him," George says. "Even Blix didn't like him." "Are you kidding me?" Paco says. "Blix for sure didn't like him."
Then he says,
"We gotta stop this kind of talk. Marnie, she like him fine. Sorry."
"Well, it's not him I'm eating with anyway," I say. "It's Patrick."
"Oh, Patrick,"
they say in unison, and then they exchange glances. "What? What about Patrick?"
"Nothing, nothing at all. You go see Patrick. Here, extra potatoes. Patrick need potatoes. And here's a bone for your doggie. Tell Patrick I got the special almond flour he wants. And the Irish butter."
"I'll pay for them and take them over to him. It'll save him a trip."
George laughs a little. "You mean it saves me a trip?" "Patrick no comes here," says Paco. "We take to him."
"Oh," I say. "Of course." Patrick lets me in when I ring the bell. I notice he's not wearing his hoodie tonight, which gives him a welcoming look, much less ominous than usual. Also, Roy runs right over to say hi, a function of the chicken I'm carrying, no doubt. Still, I feel as though they're both happy to see me for once. The lobster incident must have been forgiven. The place smells like something amazing is about to come out of the oven.
"Vanilla cheesecake,"
he tells me.
"My old standard."
I give him the almond flour and the butter, and he looks like a kid at Christmas.
"This butter is the best. Let me pay you for these,"
he says, but I wave him off and take everything into the kitchen. Then, as happens sometimes, I suddenly remember that I am a dog owner, and that you have to let dogs out. Often. I've learned this the hard way. Also, he needs company. He gets lonely. I look at Patrick apologetically. "I need to go take Bedford for a little walk, and then I'll come right back. You can start eating if you want. I know it's late."
"No, no. I'll wait for you."
"Well, thanks. I'll hurry." Bedford is frantically happy to see me, way happier than anything I can imagine Roy doing, even at his best. I take him out of the crate, and he races to the front door, his ears flying.
So I clip the leash onto his collar, and we go sailing down the front steps. The stoop! And he tears over to the little patch of dirt near the ginkgo tree and lets loose a long stream of pee. Then he has about 50 things that require sniffing, and some items he has to stop and chew, like a candy wrapper and a piece of somebody's shoe. I take these things away from him, and he briefly considers whether we know each other well enough for me to take those kinds of liberties. But I win, because I know the secret phrase, and I'm not afraid to use it. Do you want to eat? Do you want to go inside and eat? Eat? And boy, does he ever. We go racing up the stairs and back into the house, and I feed him in the kitchen. Some dry kibble mixed with a little meaty wet food that smells awful. I clock his eating time at 36 seconds, and then I tell him the bad news. You have to go back in the crate, my dear friend. He lies down with his head on his paws and makes his eyes look round and innocent. I know, but it's only for a little while. It's because Patrick is worried you would eat his cat. He wags his tail, which is probably a yes. When I get back downstairs, Patrick has put food on our plates, and we sit down at his table, which I notice he has cleared of papers and books. He's using a nice yellow tablecloth, and there's even music coming from one of the computer monitors. Bach fugues. Very tinkly pianos. He's poured us glasses of wine and made an incredible salad with walnuts and seeds and butter lettuce. I unfold my napkin in my lap and look across at him. You've gone to some trouble, I say. Thank you.
Well, it's the least I can do for a fellow trooper.
He smiles and lifts his glass in a toast.
To Blix, away from us for 2 long months now.
I look closely at him, but he's holding his emotions in check, probably for my sake. To Blix, who is still watching over us, I say.
And also I have some news for you. I'm moving. I wanted to tell you in person.
You're moving? I put my fork down.
You sound shocked.
Well, I guess I am shocked. I never meant to disrupt your life. And also, I haven't even talked to a real estate agent yet, so who knows if this place is even going to sell. And when I go back, I was thinking I could rent out Blix's place and you and Jessica could stay on. Also, even if it did sell, you could probably negotiate staying...
No,
he says.
Thank you, but no.
May I ask, without you getting mad at me, what you're going to do?
Yes. I'm going to my sister's in Wyoming.
Wyoming?
Wyoming. The wilderness. My sister lives in a town with a population of 28. That's what it says on the sign year after year. So, obviously, when somebody dies, somebody else in town has to step up and reproduce. It's the law of the land.
Can you really be happy there? I mean, with no people around? He laughs.
Have you noticed that I don't have a lot of people around already? Frankly, I'm worried that 28 people are going to be too much for me. I'm counting on my sister to fend off the hordes.
Patrick.
Marnie.
Can you tell me what happened to you? How... He looks surprised. He refills our glasses, which is really just to give him an excuse not to look at me, I think, because we both have plenty left. And then he says slowly,
Actually, no. I can't.
Patrick, I...
No, I don't want to talk about it. Let's talk about you. We covered my life at your last visit.
He looks up and smiles. His eyes are hard to read, maybe because of the scars that pull that right eye so taut, but I can see that he's making an effort to look happy. God knows he probably wishes he could shift this back to a nice, light, polite conversation.
So, here's what I know about you. Let's see. You were married to Noah for about 2 weeks. You met Blix at his family's party. She went bonkers over you and decided to leave you her house. You, however, don't really want her house, And so you're moving back to Florida, but you feel guilty. Unnecessarily guilty, I should add.
Yes, those are my facts.
And, if I may ask, what are you doing in Florida that is so much more compelling than Brooklyn, New York? Which you seem to have taken to, I might add.
Well, I feel my mouth getting dry. It's kind of hard to explain, but at the time I inherited this house, I had actually only just settled in Florida, and I had... Well, if you want to know the real truth, I have this sort of fiancé there.
What?
He raises his eyebrows as best he can. He's trying not to laugh.
What, may I ask, is a sort of fiancé? Excuse me, but given the evidence around here, I've been under the, impression that you and Noah were back together and rekindling your...
No, we're not. I mean, not really.
You are certainly an interesting one, aren't you?
He says. He raises his glass and clinks it against mine.
To an interesting life.
I know then, by the look on his face, that he knows we sleep together. My bedroom is just above his main room. The sound travels downward, I'm sure. I feel my face grow warm. It's not, I say, and at the same time he says,
No, really, you don't have to explain anything to me. I know that life is complicated, believe me. These things, really, don't be embarrassed.
We go back to eating. I pick up my fork and spear a piece of chicken. My silverware clinks together. The Bach fugue has stopped for a moment, and in the huge silence that yawns before us, there is only the sound of me trying to rip some meat apart. I feel him looking at me. At last, I put down both the knife and the fork and square my shoulders. Okay, yes. God, this is awful to have to say out loud, but you're right. Everything you're thinking is right. I am cheating on someone, and he's probably the nicest guy in the whole world, and I never thought I would do anything like that. I'm actually horrible and insensitive and incompetent at life, and oh my God, I'm having sex with my ex, who I don't even love, and I don't even mean to be doing it. It's all a big mistake, and I don't even know if that makes it worse or better, having sex with somebody by default. I am slightly aware that he says under his breath,
Really? I wasn't. You don't have to.
But I am in this now, so I plow on, McGraw style. And my fiancé, he's so trusting and nice. And yet, Patrick, can I tell you something I've never told anyone? He is so god-awful boring that sometimes it takes all of my willpower not to throw my phone into the nearest gutter just so I don't have to hear him talking to me anymore. There. I stop, because Patrick is looking at me, and it looks, shockingly, like he's suppressing a smile. Do you even know what I'm talking about? That level of boringness? He can go on and on about the way the cleaning service shampooed his office rug, and how long it took them, and how many guys they sent to do it, and what the first guy said, and then what the second guy said. And he can also talk until the sun comes up about highway routes. Highway routes, Patrick! And I'm supposed to love him, and I probably do. But he loves me so much more than I love him, and what's so really terrible is that I broke his heart back in high school, so I can't do it again, even if it turns out that I can't love him. Do you see? There's a special kind of hell for people who break nice people's hearts twice, don't you think? And I know I don't deserve him, and that just makes it worse somehow. Oh, God, please stop looking at me. I don't even know why I'm telling you this. I am not a good person, Patrick. I came here to Brooklyn scared out of my mind, but now I see that way deep down I was just hiding from my real life and hoping Brooklyn would show me an answer. And instead, I'm stupider than ever, sleeping with my ex who doesn't love me and never loved me. Like, that's going to lead to anything good. Some experiment, he called it, in behavior for exes. We're going to have closure. My voice breaks, and I make myself stop talking. I carefully set my napkin down on the table in the heavy silence that follows and put my head in my hands. What will he do when I start to sob? I can feel the tears, all right there. A big cry is organizing itself and is going to break all over both of us soon.
Well,
he says at last.
Well, my goodness. I'm wondering if this night doesn't call for whiskey instead of wine. This may be a Chivas Regal situation.
He gets up and goes over to the cabinet and brings down a bottle and two glasses. On his way back to the table, he grabs a box of tissues and puts it in front of me. He hands me a glass of whiskey, and I stare at it because I don't drink whiskey. But I take a sip anyway, and God, it's the most terrible taste in the world, burning all the way down, but also warming me up, inch by inch. Who can drink this stuff? I take another sip and set my glass down. He's downed all of his. You know what? I thought, when I came here, I thought Blix left me the house because maybe she wanted me to be with Noah, that she set this all up. That's how crazy I am. Right after he left me, when I was desperately unhappy, I asked her once for a spell to get him back, and I thought maybe that was why she gave me the house and why he was here. The spell. He clears his throat.
I have to say that I don't think she wanted you to be with Noah.
I'm getting that idea. But why not? Why did she not really like him? You know the whole story, don't you? He hesitates, pours himself another glass.
Really? Are we going to do this?
Then he sees my face.
We are. Okay. She saw him as something of an opportunist, I think. Somebody who would take advantage. He wasn't so wonderful when she was at the end of her life and needed him to step up.
Please tell me what happened. I need to know everything. He told me he was the one who took care of her.
Are you sure you want to hear this?
I think I need to know, don't you?
All right.
He stretches out his legs and cracks his knuckles.
Well, he showed up one day when it was right near the end for her. We were all taking care of her, all her people, you know, coming and keeping her company, fixing meals, straightening, that sort of thing, mostly sitting and talking to her. And he comes along one day with no idea what's going on, doesn't even know that she's sick, much less dying. And he was shocked, of course. We all tried to help him with that, because it can be upsetting to see a loved one dying. But we started getting uncomfortable because of the way he just kept badgering her to go to the hospital. He thought she should have had surgery for the tumor, get some chemotherapy, whatever. We kept trying to talk to him, to explain to him that the time for all that had passed, and that we were there helping her make her transition. But he wasn't having it. He kept insisting that professionals needed to be called, that only they knew how to take care of people who are dying.
Oh, Patrick, how did she stand it? What did she do?
See, that's just it. The essence of Blix is to try to solve things, to love what's there. She was sad, but I think at the end she thought that she could use love to help him. She wanted to fill him up with love. The way she did. You know how she was.
There's a silence. Roy climbs up on my lap, and I pet him. Patrick is looking at us with a serious look on his face.
On the last day, he was panicking at the idea of having her die in front of him, and I get that. It's scary, watching somebody die. But she had planned it all out, and she wanted to die at home in a peaceful state. And he was determined to have medical authorities. So Lola took him next door and fed him something, just to keep him away. And, well, I sat with Blix while her breaths just kept getting farther and farther apart, and I held her hand. I told her I'd stay with her for as long as she needed, and for her to take her time, to go only when she was ready. And, well, that's it.
Oh, Patrick. I want so badly to get up and go over to him and hug him. The air is practically demanding that we hug. But I know better. The air may want us to hug, but he's not inviting that kind of attention. Instead, he gets up and walks to the sink with our plates. I lean down and give Roy my last little piece of chicken, and he takes it and jumps down from my lap and eats it next to my foot.
Hey, congratulations. You're now Roy's best friend, Patrick says.
He picks up the cat, and Roy rubs his head along Patrick's chin, along the place where the skin is pulled tight. Maybe it's because I'm possibly drunk, or maybe it's because Blix is right now in the room with us, but I suddenly get an amazing idea. It feels like the very best idea anybody in the history of the world ever had, and I stand up to deliver the news of it, so it will have the fullest possible impact. What if I threw a big dinner party? Or, I know, Thanksgiving! I'll put on a Thanksgiving dinner upstairs and invite everybody who loved her, and we'll all celebrate her life. It can be my goodbye to her, and my thank you, both at the same time.
Patrick is smiling. Look at you, he says, glowing like this. This is a big plan.
Will you come?
Well, no, but I think it's a good idea for you.
Patrick!
He leans across the table and speaks in a husky voice. Look at me, Marnie. Look at my face. You and Blix. You are the only people I've let into my life. Don't you know that by now? The only people who see me on purpose. I'll send up some cookies, some pumpkin pies, and I'll cheer for you from down here. But I can't go up there. The hideous factor kicks in.
But you are the furthest thing there is from hideous, I say. You're luminous.
My tolerance for absorbing sympathetic remarks has reached the breaking point, he says. So I think it's time to call this evening quits.
I say, Patrick! And then I look at him and set my mouth a certain way, and then I give him my most exasperated expression and roll my eyes, and then I say, Patrick, you and I both know. And then I just leave, because there's no point. Patrick's heart is closed for business. He's told me every way he knows how. 33. Marnie.
I'm afraid you're not going to like late November up here, Sammy tells me. He's waiting in my kitchen for his dad to come pick him up for their weekend together. I don't know if you realize it, but November is when everybody's teeth start to hurt.
Really?
I say. I'd heard about all the leaves falling off the trees and possible early snowfalls, but I didn't know that about the teeth.
Well, my mom works for a dentist, and she says it's because of the cold weather, that when you're outside and you breathe in the cold air, your teeth get sensitive, and then everybody goes to the dentist. That's what she said.
He starts beating on the table like it's a drum, and then gets up and does an effortless cartwheel across the kitchen floor. Then he stops and looks at me.
Also, can I tell you something else? Did you know everybody has a superpower? You know what my superpower is? I have the magic power to notice when the clock says 11:11 or 1:11. I always, always look up then. It's kind of amazing.
Wow. Well, that's a good one to have.
Sometimes I see 222 or 444 also. Not so many of the other ones, though.
I concentrate very hard on trying not to laugh.
You are clearly on your way to superhero status.
He nods seriously, then sits cross-legged on the floor for a moment, looking at me so directly that my heart stops.
He swallows hard before he speaks.
So, I have a plan for getting my mom and dad together.
You do?
Yeah, so there's a concert at school, and I'm performing at it, and I think they should both come, and then I'll get up and play my flute, or sing, or read a poem or something, and after we'll all go out for ice cream, and you can do a little spell or something on them, and I think they'll decide to get back together.
Really?
But you have to do the spell. All we need is a little bit of magic to get them both to come to the concert and be nice to each other. So far, all they do is fight about it.
They do? He sits down at the table next to me and rests his head on his elbow.
My mom yells at my dad that he won't remember to come on time and that he won't be wearing the right clothes. And then she said that I had to tell him no girlfriends allowed because she will walk out if she sees him there with some woman.
But you said he doesn't even have a girlfriend.
He doesn't! But my mom is worried anyway. Maybe she thinks he'll get one.
He starts drawing on the table again with his finger, outlining the same star that I love to outline with my finger. Then he gives me a little smile.
So, we need to look at the book of spells and find a good spell you could use on them.
I think about it.
I think we should let the concert do the magic. Play your flute, and that will be magic enough. All that beautiful music curling out over the audience.
No, he says very firmly.
We need more than that.
And if it doesn't work, I continue, then it's just not the right time. Because if it's meant to happen, it will. But things have to develop. We can't force it to happen.
Would you please even look at the Book of Spells? I know you could find something in there to help us. This girl at my school said she knows this psychic lady, and she rubs people's heads and tells them what's going to happen. So I know you could just read some words. I do it myself, except you and Blix are the ones with the magic.
How do you know that? I say. He shrugs.
I don't know. I just know it.
I glance over at the bookshelf where the Book of Spells sits, bulging with papers. Its cover looks torn. Funny how some days I don't even see it there, and some days it's the focal point of the whole kitchen. Like now. Andrew, with his usual hangdog countenance, what I assume is the result of a perpetual, lifelong guilty conscience, arrives then, and Sammy leaves with his dad, trailing his overnight bag and holding on to his soccer ball, giving me backward looks and wagging his eyebrows at me. He mouths, "Do it," as they leave. I sit there, drinking my tea for a long while, listening to the way the house settles and creaks. The windows need washing. Everything needs washing around here. I should call a real estate agent, find out what I have to do to put the place on the market. Why don't I ever seem able to set all this in motion? Bedford, lying at my feet, turns over in his sleep and thumps his tail. Tap, tap, tap. I wash the dishes and sweep the kitchen floor, then go outside to get some fresh air. The wind is whipping up the trees. Patrick has put the recycling out by the curb, and it's full of cardboard boxes and containers. I look longingly at his apartment. The windows with the wrought iron bars are a perfect metaphor for everything about Patrick. Lola's shades are up, I'm pleased to see. She got a pacemaker last week, and it's made her feel worlds better, she says, filled with energy she hasn't felt in years. I pull the dead leaves off the rose bush and then traipse up the stairs and straighten the Tibetan prayer flags on my way inside. Maybe I should call my sister. But then I find myself standing in front of the Book of Spells. It would not hurt to look at this book. I could open it up and see how ridiculous it is. Probably just a book of parlor games. Somebody probably gave it to Blix as a joke, a nod to her interest in unconventional things. I open the front cover. There are a whole bunch of papers shoved between the pages, so I take them out very carefully and set them aside. They are grocery lists, little doodles, a note Blix evidently wrote to Houndy reminding him to bring home 4 extra lobsters because Lola and Patrick were both coming over for dinner. Patrick came up for dinner? Really? All the stuff of life that you shove away somewhere when company is coming over and you aren't ready to sort through the papers cluttering the table. But the book itself? The book is trying very hard, too hard, to be serious. It has a whole section about the history of spells, blah, 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 an explanation of how humans have always thought they needed to claim some influence over the vagaries of life. And then, getting down to business, there are some 5,000 actual spells for everything. Cleansing energy, winning court cases, ensuring protection, finding lost objects, healing disease, getting money, and, of course, a huge section on love and sex. In the love section, there are mentions of ingredients for a proper spell. Rosemary, roses, chamomile, some vanilla beans wouldn't hurt. A piece of paper falls out onto the floor. On it, I see that someone has written in a scratchy light scrawl, "Lola, open heart, love, brave, dream. You know the man now, the man who will love you." At the very back of the book, there's a thin green leather journal wedged between a couple of pages, wrapped up with a brown cord with a star charm attached. I shouldn't open this. Blix's secrets are there, I'm sure of it. But maybe she wanted me to see it. This isn't exactly hidden away, after all. She could have destroyed all the things she didn't want found. It wasn't like her death surprised her. She knew for ages she was going to die. No, I am certain she put everything exactly where she wanted it, and for a purpose. My hand touches the leather cord, and I take a deep breath, and then I'm pulling on it slightly and opening the journal. I'll read a little bit, I tell myself. See if she mentioned me. I have a right to know if I was mentioned in her journal, don't I? After all, she left me her house. Maybe there are instructions here on what else I should be doing. And there it is. The thing that breaks my heart. She has listed the spells she was using for healing, and the date she employed each one, and the results. The Acorn Good Health spell, for instance, that she used the previous fall. I threw the acorns in the air. They scattered over the ground. On another page of her journal, I'm frightened sometimes in the morning. I look at Houndy, and I feel the fear. But it's not like I'm desperate, she wrote in a beautiful looping scrawl with curlicues and little stars. Everyone thinks medical science can cure this cancer. Why don't they see what I see? That death is not the enemy. Here, she drew a starburst. I know that my tumor is a living entity and that the tumor and I together can heal ourselves if it is meant to be that way. I turn the page and see, I am not afraid of death, and I am not afraid of life. These days are full of passion and love and richness now that I know the end is coming. I carry the ocean in my blood. I float out into the night, knowing that when the time comes, I will leave on the luminous, huge, milky moon. I am disappearing by degrees, yet I want to stay longer, look back at my whole glorious life. Where did you go? Later, she invoked Obatala, whatever that is, and said she'd gone out at night, offering him milk and coconut for healing. She summoned the dark moon spirit and the ancient Egyptian fumigation for expelling disease demons. My heart is beating hard. Oh my goodness, she did use spells. I am wearing the special blessing crystals and the amber beads, she wrote. But Cassandra is strong. I am making myself ready, but sometimes I am filled with a longing to stay. Is that so bad, to want to stay a bit longer, to see my projects through? There's a buzzing in my ears. I run my fingers over her printing.
Where she wrote Cassandra's name, the handwriting is jazzy, almost childlike, with lowercase letters all in different colors. She dug into the paper so hard that when I run my fingers over the name, the writing feels almost three-dimensional. A few more pages in, Houndy calling to me from the other side. Last night I saw my mother and my grandmother and sat with them in an orchard. My mother told me that I know what I need to do. I had a conversation with Houndy, and he reached over and touched my arm, and it left a little mark. He says Patrick will see me through. Patrick knows the way. I am fingering the pages, letting my eyes drift over them, when I hear the front door slam. I jump up, startled and guilty. Bedford lifts his head and wags his tail.
Marnie, you home?
Calls Noah up the stairs, and I close the book quickly, shoving the journal deep inside, except that as I do, I see my name on a tiny piece of paper lodged into the binding of the book, and I pull it out, fast. At the top, she's written the date, September 10th, which I remember was the day before she died. The handwriting looks like it was scratched with a pencil that had hardly any lead left to it. I have to strain to see what it says. Then my heart twists. She has written, in capital letters, each one etched deep into the paper, Marnie, Noah has to leave. Do not let him stay. 34. Marnie. I've only barely managed to stash the book of spells away when Noah clumps up the stairs, bringing his jangly, disruptive vibes into the room. Blix didn't want Noah here. Blix didn't want Noah here. Blix didn't want Noah here. That sentence runs through my head in a continuous loop. And now here he is, standing in front of me, eyes crinkled in a smile, and I'm in the middle of the kitchen, feeling like a trapped animal. Who stands in the very middle of the kitchen, for heaven's sake? And who stands there looking like she just completed the 100-yard dash to arrive there, cheeks flushed, hair standing on end, looking like she's just seen a ghost? I feel I am seeing the truth of things. Everybody tried to tell me she didn't mean to leave the place to Noah, that she didn't want him here, and somehow I dismissed everything they said. But now here it is, in her own words, the day before she died. He stops and stares at me, and a grin spreads across his face.
Hey, what are you doing?
He says.
What's going on?
And for some reason, his eyes drift over to the bookshelf. Maybe I've run from there so fast that a trail is still visible. Marnie, Noah has to leave. Do not let him stay.
Nothing. Just fixing up a few things. Cleaning a little bit. This place gets so dirty.
He laughs, then comes over and puts his arms around me. I feel myself bristle, but he pulls me to him, presses my face against his chest.
No, really. What's with you? Did I scare you when I came in?
No, I say into his shirt.
God, you look sexy today.
He kisses the top of my head.
So, what do you say? We go downstairs and have sex. I just got done with my paper, it's the weekend, and I feel like celebrating, especially when you look so hot. Did you do something to your hair?
Nothing. It's just uncombed. And actually, I was about to go out.
Yeah? Where to?
I was going to see Lola, see how she's doing.
She just left. I saw her when I was coming in, leaving with that man again.
Really? I pull away from him. The New Jersey guy?
I didn't exactly talk to him to find out where he's from.
His car has out-of-state plates. If you looked at them, you'd know. He laughs.
What do I care what the license plates say?
I bet it was him, which is great, but never mind.
Anyway,
he says. He points to himself and to me, tries to take me in his arms again.
So,
I don't want to have sex with him. I do not want to have sex with him.
I manage to extricate myself and go over to the sink and turn on the tap. I'll water the plants.
That's right.
Actually, I can't just now. After I finish up in here, I'm going out.
So you said. But Lola's gone.
Yeah?
I told you. She left with a guy. And you said that was great news. What's up with you anyway? Are you all right?
Tell me something. What was Blix like when you got here? I walk carefully to the window with the water glass. I can feel him looking at me as I drizzle some water over the roses and then the chamomile.
She was dying,
he says after a moment.
I got here a week before she died.
And tell me the truth. Did she want you here?
Are you kidding? She said I was the one who could help her make the transition to the other side.
He comes over and takes the glass out of my hand, puts it on the table, and holds on to both my arms.
What is going on?
He leans closer, starts running his lips down across my jaw. I pull back and look at his face. Nothing. I was just thinking how it must have been very hard for you to see her that way. Dying. He flushes.
You know what was hard? It was hard that she wouldn't do anything to help herself get well. God forbid anybody call a doctor. I wanted to help her, but she just wanted me to sit there and watch her die.
I pull away from him. But she had the right to do it her way.
Well, sure. But my point is, why was I the guy who had to watch it happen? That's what hospitals are for. But whatever, I did it anyway. For her. And then, she goes and leaves her place to you.
He gives a short, bitter little laugh. I don't think her death was about you.
Well, whatever. It's done. I did what she wanted. Case closed. It's all good.
He runs his eyes over me and holds out his arms, smiling.
Why are we talking about this anyway? Let's go make ourselves happy. You and me? Downstairs?
He motions with his head toward the door. But I can't. In fact, looking at him right now, I can't believe I ever let myself get involved with such a self-absorbed, egotistical child who can only see things from his own perspective. I actually feel a little sick. No, I say. I swallow, trying to locate some moisture in my mouth because it has suddenly gone dry. Actually, I have to tell you that this isn't really working for me anymore.
What?
I feel weird about what I'm doing. I shouldn't be with you like this when I'm getting married to someone else. I feel guilty. This is a terrible thing I'm doing. He looks shocked for a moment, and then he smiles and revs up the charm machine.
Ah, guilt. It's a terrible thing when guilt gets in the way of fun, isn't it? But here's what I think. We shouldn't feel guilty, because in the grand scheme of things, you and me having sex is not taking anything away from your boyfriend. I'm no threat to your relationship, because one, I'm a known quantity, and two, I'm screwed up and can't maintain a decent relationship. You're his, as far as I'm concerned. This is all recreational. Look at it this way. I am strictly for fun.
I don't work that way, unfortunately, I say.
Yes, you do. That's exactly what we've been doing, having fun. And there's nothing wrong with it.
I can't do it anymore. I'm sorry I ever started. So please, respect my wishes on this. He gives me a sideways look. I know I'm sounding weird, so stiff and formal, but I can't help it. I'm still shaking. He goes over and opens the refrigerator, stares into it, and finally gets out a beer. I know he's playing for time, waiting to see if I come to my senses. When I don't say anything else, he finally lets out a big breath, takes a swig of the beer, and says,
okay, have it your way. I'll respect your wishes, and we'll chill on the sex,
but I have to stay here until the semester's over.
No, I want you to leave.
Marnie? Fuck, what is this?
I stand in the middle of the kitchen, shaking my head, standing my ground. It feels like Blix and everybody who loved her is standing right there alongside me.
No, I can't have you here. You have to leave.
He stares at me, and for a moment I think he'll challenge me, or refuse, or even throw a fit. But then he laughs, takes another big drink of beer, and shakes his head as though this is the most insane request he's ever heard. He picks up his backpack and goes downstairs. I hear the shower running. Soon after, there's the sound of drawers banging shut, and his footsteps in the hallway, and then the front door slams. I watch from the window as he heads down the street, talking on his phone. That night, I take the book of spells down to my room and lie in bed, anxious to get back to Blix's journal. I love how she filled pages with stars and filigrees and comets. I love the stories of little glimmers she felt as she watched people falling in love around her. She wrote that she sometimes sent out messages and energy through the atmosphere and saw people turn in surprise when they got zapped with love. She was a person like no one I ever met. Then I smile, remembering the engagement party and how we surrounded a red-haired woman with white light. And for a moment, I feel her there with me in the room. I read lists of things she was grateful for. The random heart-shaped leaves on the sidewalk, the pigeons who talked to her from the windowsill, her cantha quilt, Patrick's sculptures with their grace and power, the way she and Houndy would sit by the fire pit on snowy nights, curled up together under fleece blankets, Sammy's smile. How important it was to add to every spell, for the good of all and free will of all. And then, in the very back of the book, on the very last page, she'd made a list called My Projects. Jessica and Andrew, Lola and William, Patrick and Marnie. Patrick and Marnie, Patrick and Marnie, Patrick and Marnie. I close the book very carefully and place it on the floor. Patrick? Patrick is the one she thought was for me? It's so impossible as to almost be laughable. Patrick is so locked up in himself, he's so unreachable, and what did she think I was supposed to do? Spend the rest of my life writing to him on my phone? We could gradually work up to love notes in our texts. Maybe after 20 years of me texting I love you, he might let me actually touch him. Oh, Blix, maybe you got some things right, but this was so very, very wrong. 35. Marnie. The next day, I'm at Best Buds, texting the news to Patrick that I've asked Noah to leave, when I look up to see the elderly man coming in the door, the one who wasn't ready. This time, however, he masterfully strides over and picks out calla lilies, roses, some baby's breath, some Gerbera daisies, and some greens. Gerbera daisies are my very favorite flower, I tell him when he brings them over to the counter. This seems to please him. He has a sweet face, lined and gentle.
I am about to do a very brave thing, he says. His eyes are shining. Braver than anything I did in the war, that's for sure. I am going to ask a woman to marry me.
Really? I say. That's wonderful! Is she going to be surprised, or does she already know?
It's a surprise. Actually, do you have paper so I can write a note? It occurs to me that it might be a very good idea to include a little note, convincing her.
Oh, boy. You're going to propose marriage on paper?
He stiffens a little.
I am.
No, that's cool. I get it. Do you want some help?
I have to do this myself,
he tells me sternly.
This has to be all me. Though it's been years, you know, since I had to, convince a lady that I'm worth investing in.
Of course. Here, you can sit over here and take your time. I lead him over to a little white table in the back. Can I get you some water? Or maybe a thesaurus? Or a romance novel? He laughs at that. He sits for a long time, chewing on the end of his pen. Patrick texts back,
Great. Did he go peacefully into that good night? Did you see what I did there?
Ha! He did go peacefully. So far, at least.
The man turns, clears his throat, and says, Maybe I could use a little help if you have some time.
I put down my phone. I love doing this, I say. Tell me something about her. And you. I'll see what comes up.
He sighs. All right, maybe that would work.
He closes his eyes and begins.
So I've been seeing this lady. I drive from New Jersey to visit her. Been doing it for about 6 months now. Every chance I can. Every chance she'll let me.
Little sparkles are dancing around in front of my eyes. Oh, my God. This is him.
And, she's the widow of my best friend. She doesn't know I want to be more than a friend to her because I haven't wanted to scare her off. But we only talk about our dead spouses and current events, weather, plays. She doesn't know I have feelings. She's very proper with me.
I clear my throat. What are the ethics of this situation? Should I say, Hey, you're William Sullivan, and I know your whole story. Let me tell you what the lady in question has said to me about you. Instead, I go with, But is it the kind of proper like, keep your distance, or is it the kind of proper like, I don't want to assume this man loves me?
I really do want to know which one it is. Now, how would I know that?
He says.
That's why I'm going to propose marriage, to see what she says.
He gets a mock serious look on his face.
I am, as they say, taking the plunge.
Oh, Lola is going to break his heart. This is not going to go well.
Yes, I say, but if, I mean, won't it be too sudden?
It might put her on the spot, you know? Why plunge when you could wade? Tiptoe in, test the waters.
No, absolutely not. When I asked my wife to marry me, that's what I did, and it worked out just fine. I asked her while we were getting some ice cream. Popped the question, and she dropped her ice cream cone on the ground. She was so surprised. And then she said yes. I had to buy her another cone. Best money I ever spent.
There is something so lovely about his face, the expression in his eyes, all that cluelessness. And even larger, there's something so sad about men of that generation crashing through life, taking plunges, with no idea of how women are going to receive them. Or maybe it's adorable, and these are darling men, heroes on the mysterious front lines of love, and women need to pamper them and save them from their craziest impulses. I can't think of what to do. I think we may need us some proposing music to help us along, I tell him, to stall for time. I go put on some Frank Sinatra love songs, and then we sit side by side in the shower of gold sprinkles and let the fragrance of the flowers wash over us. I close my eyes and say Blix's mantra, whatever happens, love that, to myself.
So I need her to see me as a bold romantic partner,
he is saying. But could she perhaps be shy around you,
Have you considered that maybe you want to take it slow?
He laughs.
I now realize what's wrong with your generation. You don't take chances. You're always on your smartphones and with your texting and your swiping and your online dating.